This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. I was just helping a friend who was looking for a psychotherapist. I have a psychologist friend who I trust, but she's become more of an author and media celebrity. So she gave me a list of therapists she trusts. And at the top of her list, I kid you not, is BetterHelp.com. And it's not just her. Check out the reviews at BetterHelp.com/reviews. There's 1.7 million of them, with an average live therapy session rating of 4.9 out of 5. That's because these aren't random online therapists, but vetted ones with at least 3 years and 1,000 hours of experience and certifications across a wide range of specialties. It's easy to get started. Just go to BetterHelp.com, answer a few questions, and get matched with a therapist based on your needs. Switch whenever you like if it's not the right fit. So see the reviews, see what stands out, and see if BetterHelp is right for you. Visit BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. It took a special company to convince me to do an ad for clothing, and that company is Quince. Imagine buying fewer, better pieces you love to wear all the time instead of an infinite scroll of crap. The best piece I got so far is a navy blue button-down shirt, the organic cotton stretch textured twill shirt, and it replaces like six others that got stolen from the laundromat last month. Feels different, fits different, and washes great. No crunchy crease in the elbows or itchy seams at the wrist, just soft structure, refined, casual details, no strings dangling. You'll see it in my next monologue. So buy less, buy better, look great, win jobs, meet lovers, organically, ethically, and at reasonable prices with Quince. Have a closet of keepers, not landfill. Upgrade your everyday. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/teamhuman. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/teamhuman.
With no fees or minimums on checking accounts, it's no wonder the Capital One Bank guy is so passionate about banking with Capital One. If he were here, he wouldn't just tell you about no fees or minimums. He'd also talk about how most Capital One cafes are open 7 days a week to assist with your banking needs. Yep, even on weekends, it's pretty much all he talks about. In a good way. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank. Capital One N.A. member FDIC.
Hi, you're on Team Human. I'm Douglas Rushkoff. Here's a little bonus track we're dropping into the feed. It's a book event, kind of an online book party that Medium threw me on the launch of Survival of the Richest: Escape Fantasies of the Tech Billionaires, which began as an article on Medium about my strange experience consulting to a group of billionaire preppers. As a way of celebrating the book, as well as what can happen when you post a story on Medium, their director of creative growth, the wonderful Adrian Samuels Gibbs, hosted a Twitter Spaces conversation with me about the book, its themes, and the journey from idea to article to book to, yes, movie. I hope you like it.
Thanks for joining us for this very special Medium in Conversation with Douglas Rushkoff. I am Adrian Gibbs, and I am the Director of Creative Growth here at Medium, and we're so glad to see you. We're going to wait a little bit. Oh, there's a lot of you here. I said we're going to wait a little bit for a few more people to join in, but there is no time like the present, right, Douglas? So, okay, so here's what's happening. If you've read Left Behind, if you've watched Westworld, if you follow the folks at various economic forums around the world, if you're curious about interplanetary colonization or flight and are horrified or intrigued by fiction such as The Handmaid's Tale, then this Twitter Spaces is for you. Thank you for joining us today for Medium in Conversation with Professor Douglas Rushkoff. He is a professor of media theory and digital economics at the City University of New York, Queens. Also, he's named one of the world's 10 most influential intellectuals by MIT. And of course, he writes on Medium and hosts the Team Human podcast. And on top of that, has written many, many award-winning books. I think I counted 20, but correct me if I'm wrong. We are talking today about Douglass's wildly sought after thoughts and ideas. After all, very important people tend to fly him in for private lectures about how to avoid or embrace a dystopian future. We're also discussing his hot book, came out this week, Survival of the Richest, The Escape Fantasies of Tech Billionaires. He is the person everyone wants to talk to right now about human survival. Now, if that sounds like a little bit of science fiction and a little bit of conspiracy theory, no one could blame you. Except we're not really talking Illuminati. We're not talking hidden groups. We're talking right now. Douglass's book, which started out as an essay on Medium, analyzes the mindset of the people who have already prepared for this extinction-level event and the people who are financing and building the tech and the apps and the armies that they think will carry them through. They do plan to leave the rest of us behind. So, let's get into it. Hi, Douglass. Thanks for joining us. Happy Friday. Happy book launch week.
Happy book launch week. It's a crazy one. I did Coast to Coast AM the other night, so now I'm totally turned around. You know, the old Art Bell show, speaking of conspiracy theory, it was fun to think about all this that way, though. Because for me, the whole point of this, I mean, honestly, is to learn to laugh at these ideas and these people. You know, I wrote up this book as a black comedy so that instead of kind of believing the apocalypse fantasies of the tech billionaires, we can kind of laugh at them and realize how they don't work and then get on with the good, fun project of avoiding that altogether.
Right. Avoiding it altogether. That's something that no one talked about in your book. It was except for you.
Yeah.
So, which is fascinating. So I'd like to start, you know, as all things do, at the beginning. You wrote that you were invited to basically give a billionaire bunker lecture in the middle of the desert with people who seriously wanted your opinion about how they're going to make it work after the apocalypse. Can you share a little bit more about this?
Yeah. I mean, if I knew I was being invited to that, I would have been less reluctant to go. What they invited, because that sounds like fun. What they invited me for was, you know, the typical, you know, a bunch of rich people want you to come out. I mean, it basically an overpriced talk on, you know, the future of the digital economy or something like that, which again is, you know, totally not my area of expertise, right? I'm a media theorist. I think about things. If I'm an expert in anything, I'm an expert in the present. It's just that most business people are so far behind that telling them about the present is their way of understanding the future, or you can at least see some of the early signals of what's going on. So I thought I was being brought out for that, and you know, and I'm in the green room waiting to do this talk, you know, and I always try to bring a good lefty kind of anarcho-syndicalist mindset to these folks, you know, try to help, you know, chip away at their mental armor is my sort of, at least the way I justify going and speaking to them. And, you know, I'm getting my notes ready, and instead of making me up and bringing me out, they brought these five guys into the green room who start peppering me with all the typical kind of business speculative questions, you know, Ethereum or Bitcoin, mm-hmm. VR, AR, then finally, you know, Alaska, New Zealand. And the whole rest of the time, it was them kind of water testing their survival strategies. And the question that we ended up on for most of the hour was the weird, almost walking dead-like question of, you know, how do I maintain control of my security force after the event? Because they know their money's going to be worthless. They've hired all these Navy SEALs armed to the teeth to protect their compound from the like of you and me, who don't have, you know, you know, whatever, vertical farming, hydroponic, you know, cryptographic, you know, whatever right. They're going to have in their bunkers. And it was interesting because to me, that question is the whole question, you know, which is really what they've been asking all along. How do I detach from everybody else and kind of rule them from above? How do I get to go live in the Web3 metaverse? You know, how do I upload my mind? How do I justify putting a bunch of Amazon doorbells on the front of my house and never talking to another human being again?
So they were there and then they don't want to be here or something like that. You wrote this, you know, did you, when they were peppering you with these questions, did you take them seriously at first, or was it, or did you already have an inkling this is where we were going?
You know, honestly, I mean, I don't know if I've admitted this to anyone. When they first asked me these questions, I thought I was being punked. You know, I really thought there was this, I remember at the end of the first season of, what was Donald Trump's show, The Apprentice? You know, yeah. They're doing one of these meetings and then the walls fell down and you see that you're in front of a giant audience. I was like waiting for the walls around the room to fall down and there to be a few thousand people going, ah, ha, ha, you believe this? It was really happening. But no, it was really happening. And then I was terrified because I figured, look at these are, you know, smarter, richer, whatever people than me. And they've determined that there's this huge probability of this thing happening. And this is what they're doing. Then I got sad thinking, you know, these are the most powerful, wealthiest people I've ever been in the same room with. And they feel utterly powerless and ineffectual, impotent to influence the future. If they feel impotent, my God. And then by the end, when they were asking me these questions about how to maintain control of their security guards, I started to think they were ridiculous, that they were that they were jokes. They were not society's winners. They were really sad losers. And I ended up telling them, you know, the way to prevent your head of security from shooting you between the eyes when you're in the bunker is to pay for his daughter's bat mitzvah today. And they didn't even understand what I was trying to tell them. But basically, I was trying to say, look, you be nice to these people now and they won't kill you later. And maybe, just maybe, if you're nice to people rather than just trying to extract their money and data, you know, at any cost and externalize the damage to our psychology and our environment and our geopolitical situation, if you actually thought of the world not as a neighborhood to move out of, but as a neighborhood to take care of, then maybe, just maybe, you know, you won't have to escape at all.
You know, it's interesting you talk about neighborhoods, because it made me think about, you know, the, you know, kind of American city legacy of white flight. Mm-hmm. And what's happening here. I know some people are talking about going to Mars and some are talking about going underground. You did interview some of the companies, I'm not sure how that worked. Did they contact you after your essay, or you contacted them?
More contacted me. It was interesting. A bunch of these companies contacted me because, you know, here's five, you know, they just wanted the names of the billionaires to get on there. These are good. What are they called? Verified leads or whatever it's called, you know, yes. Qualified leads for sales. But, you know, most of them were just, these are crazy companies, you know, trying to sell, you know, a bunch of shipping containers that they're going to shove under the ground and outfit with heated swimming pools and jacuzzis. Like, where do you get the spare parts for a swimming pool after the apocalypse? You're like, this doesn't really work. But one of them I kind of liked. I mean, he was a true MAGA right-wing guy. He used to run an embassy in like Latvia or something, or the Chamber of Commerce or whatever. And mm-hmm. he had an idea to do these kind of very sustainable old school farms where you've got, you know, roosters and chicken and biodiesel. And what he wanted was the billionaires would pay him like $5 or $10 million to guarantee a space in the farm, but then it's also a business that's supposed to be teaching other people around the country how to create these farms themselves. Because his logic was, you know, he wants it to be guarded. And I said, so what do you do if, you know, a motorcycle gang comes with a ton of, you know, machine guns, like in Walking Dead, it's always these gangs. And he said, I'm less scared, I'm less concerned about the motorcycle gang than the woman at the end of the driveway holding a baby starving. And I was like, wow, you know, and just that he's even thinking that far ahead. So what he wanted was to invest in education for other people so that there are fewer people at the gates, because he understands the sustainability of his sustainable farm is going to be dependent on, some of the rest of the world being able to take care of themselves too. And as a result, he's been unable to get any of these billionaires interested in his project. They're like, oh, there's a weakness. There's a fault in your plan, and that you're trying to help other people.
Try, you know, and that's the thing. It's the people that makes the systems work. So I thought it was kind of typically, I know that AI and machine learning and things like that come into play here. And I wanted to talk to you about that. There was a part of your book where you talked about how some billionaires are using their money to research and to find better ways to optimize age old farming practices as a way to kind of cancel out the middleman. But like you said, with your example about the pool, who does this work? Are these billionaires really going to be like farming underground and cleaning their own pools and adjusting the shock? Is that a thing?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, I think that they've bought into one of Silicon Valley's great lies, which is that all of these robots and automation replace labor. You know, like you could go on Amazon and they'll like make a t-shirt just made for you by computer and robots and, you know, no human hands. That's not really true. It's like all the robots are really doing is camouflaging another level of labor. There's still humans picking the cotton and digging the rare earth metals out of the ground for the robots. And, you know, your 3D printer may print the object, but where did the plastic goop come from? Where did the components come from? Where does the printer go when you throw it out and get another one? You know, so it's like, where do we draw the boundaries around the so-called computerized labor? You know, that's what I started to call it, the dumbwaiter effect. You know, that I remember being taught, I remember in middle school, they showed us the dumbwaiter and said, wasn't this great? You know, Thomas Jefferson really cared about his enslaved people. So he made this sort of little pulley thing. So, you know, they could just put the food in there and then you'd pull a little pulley and then it would just, you know, automatically appear up where the diners are eating on the second floor. It's like, that wasn't put there to save the enslaved people the labor of walking up the stairs. They were already walking a mile in underground tunnels to bring the food and everything else down there. It's to spare the guests the horror of seeing the enslaved person. So the technologies that we use very often are really just here to help insulate us from the human impact of what we're doing.
Okay. See, that's the interesting part about this through line of your book. And I'm going to reset the room. Hello, everyone who has just joined us for this very special Medium in Conversation. We are talking with Douglas Rushkoff, the author of Survival of the Richest, Escape Fantasies of the Tech Billionaires. And we were just going over how he came to the idea of this story and then moving into AI and robots and all that good stuff. Thanks for joining us. If any of you all have any questions, feel free to at Medium, and near the end of our chat, we're going to get to some questions from Medium members and, of course, from anybody else who has joined the chat. Okay, so Douglas, here is my next question about individualism.
Yeah.
You talked a lot about individualism, about colonialism, and about the mindset. And for everybody listening, you know, in the book, he calls the mindset, it's got a capital M mindset. And it was a through line of the book, this take, build better, sell, burn, move, take, build better, sell, burn, move. It was like, okay, can you talk about the capital M mindset?
Yeah, I mean, the mindset is sort of this, you know, embracing concept, and it certainly started a long time ago. I mean, you could say that Alexander the Great and Augustus Caesar, who Mark Zuckerberg loves, you know, they all had the mindset, you know, exactly, take, dominate. You know, it goes all the way back to, you know, Francis Bacon saying, you know, empirical science will allow us to take nature by the forelock, hold her down, and submit her to our will. You know, it's that. But these days, what I look at the mindset is kind of this tech billionaire belief that with enough money and technology, they can escape the catastrophes they're creating by using money and technology in that way, right? It's this idea that you could somehow build a car that can go fast enough to escape from its own exhaust. And the things, the kind of the tributaries to this mindset is this belief that humanity is a problem to be solved with technology. And that's sort of the dangerous thing. They think of themselves as
well, they take Stuart Brand at his word as gods. You know, we are as gods and may as well start acting like it. We are one level above mere mortals. It's what Peter Thiel really means when he says go from zero to one, that you should exist one order of magnitude, 10x above everybody else. It's what Zuckerberg means when Facebook starts failing and he's like, oh, no, we're going to go meta, right? So wave hands, crypto, VR, blockchain, something meta above. It's web three, not web two. It's game B versus game A. And it's this understanding that, you know, it's almost a Richard Dawkins-like staunch atheistic belief that humans are just at the mercy of selfish genes. And it's guys like Jeffrey Epstein who will look to a Dawkins or a technologist for any evidence that whatever he does doesn't matter. There's no soul. This is just flesh. This is just flesh with genes. May as well be my genes in that flesh and keep going. And it leads to such a kind of a brittleness. You know, it's why they have this insulation equation, because they really just want to be able to live by the biases of digital code, you know, and understand human relationships purely as market phenomenon. Women and nature and Black people and Indigenous people are all this scary, unpredictable stuff that we can just reduce somehow with our own IP, you know, and achieve sovereignty over them and ultimately sovereignty over the self, which is the strangest part. I mean, self-sovereignty in a way is the pinnacle of the mindset. Self-sovereignty. So you don't just objectify nature, women, and everyone else. You objectify yourself and become king of that dude, you.
King of you. I mean, that's what it sounds like with, you know, trying to save your body parts and upload your brain into the into something. You said going meta, you know, I guess I don't know, web four, web five. And this is how the tech plays into it, because, you know, the title being Escape Fantasies of the Tech Billionaires. But when we talked about who's doing this work, so how do we, you know, for those of us who don't yet have the escape hatch, I am one of them.
Uh-oh. You're a little late.
I'm a little late. I just haven't been able to find all of the metals I need to make it. What are we to do? I mean, what are the rest of us to do? Does the Earth have a shot at making it better so that nobody has to leave?
Oh, yeah. You know, believe it or not, avoiding the requirement of catastrophe is still so much easier than trying to survive it. You know, it's like, I understand, like what you're talking about before with white flight. You know, my dad was raised in an awful, you know, tenement neighborhood in New York, and his pride of his life was making enough money, working hard enough so he could get out of that neighborhood and raise his family somewhere better. But what about when the whole earth is the neighborhood, right? You can't leave. You got to go, okay, I better make the neighborhood better. And that's way easier for us to do than them, because we're still here in the real world. We're not up in their eco-farmed, you know, software stack, vertical farming preserve. You know, we're not committed to that. We're not afraid of other people. So it's really as easy as, and I know it sounds like a dirty word these days, but embracing a bit of degrowth, of slowing down a little bit, realizing that does every household on the block need a minimum viable product lawnmower from Home Depot? Or would we be better off buying one good lawnmower and then sharing it amongst these 10 or 15 houses?
Oh.
Ooh, I know.
Oh, who says share?
That's blasphemy, though. That's the enemy. Then the obvious question is like, well, what does the lawnmower company do? What about the jobs of the lawnmower people? What about the GDP? It's like, since when was were we put here to serve the economy? Right? The economy was here to serve us. So once we can flip it, we realize, oh, wow, you know, we've got the figure in the ground reversed, the cart and the horse. It's gone opposite. Just as, and digital technology is the most obvious example of how we did that. We took these tools that were here for helping us express ourselves, our collective imagination in new ways, and we turned them on the people, right? We don't have people using technology. We have technology looking for exploits in humans. And the people who do that get rich, And the people who do that, who do get rich, get correspondingly less empathetic. That's what our latest studies are showing, is that the wealthier you get, the less empathy you have for other people. It's as if, and this is what neuroscientists are saying, it's as if they've had brain trauma. The frontal lobes don't respond to pictures of other people in pain. So that's not the direction we want to go.
Not at all. Not at all. And this degrowth, this embrace of degrowth, how does that square with GDP?
Does life square with GDP? What is GDP? Why does GDP have to grow? GDP has to grow because some 12th century European monarchs were trying to stop the rise of the merchant class in the marketplace, who were using peer-to-peer currencies. They outlawed them and came up with central currency so they could lend it to people to transact and then collect interest on it. The only reason the economy has to grow is to satisfy the underlying operating system of central currency, which was made to help 12th century people stay rich by being rich. They're dead. They've long since left the building. This economic system served colonialism. It was great for conquistadors and anyone who was willing to enslave people and steal their resources. It doesn't work in a civilization's middle age. It's not a sustainable approach, particularly when we're running digital companies that require now exponential hockey stick growth. You end up with perversions like Bitcoin, which is literally, we are going to burn the planet in order to convert carbon into a digital symbol system, right? We are delivering planet to a digital symbol. That's bizarre. It's like a version of biblical sacrifice, you know, writ large, right? To a God that is a spreadsheet.
A spreadsheet God. And we talk about the God complex, the spreadsheet God. And, you know, everyone who's just chiming in, we're talking about survival of the richest, the escape fantasies of the tech billionaires, and also talking to Douglas Rushkoff about not just this book, but also his many, many ideas. And his words and where they're coming from. There's a whole chapter in the book about this history of this kind of system that's led us to where we are in the world right now with capitalism. I found it fascinating. You really broke down in a chapter what other people have taken many, many books to say. And I as a writer myself, I also really appreciated that. And, you know, I want to back up a little bit to ask you about the literal writing of this. I know you penned the first essay. Well, you published the first essay anyway in 2018. Don't know when you wrote it, but since then you've written several books, and you write on Medium, and you have your podcast, and you're teaching students.
Yeah.
How are you balancing this writing? Are you writing daily? I mean, how are you doing this?
You know, honestly, right now, I'm not balancing it well. You know, I think I'm squeezing a little bit too much product out of the person. But it's partly because I have a sense of urgency. You know, I have a daughter who's going to be going to college soon and going out into this world. And I think of our world and so many aspects of our civilization as salvageable. I really don't think it has to end. And there's so many intellectuals and friends of mine who've become, you know, it's a science fiction idea originally, but they become, you know, what's called accelerationists, that they really think the whole thing is doomed. So we might as well pedal to the metal and let this system break down so we can restart, we can reboot, you know, control, alt, delete the whole thing, which is sort of where, you know, Bannon, Thiel, and Musk all sort of meet on a certain similar spectrum of, you know, let's get to the next thing. Let's just get to game B already and let go of game A. This thing. And I'm not there. I have a much more incremental, gentle, loving theory of change. I don't think we need to sacrifice the well-being of the 8 billion people who are alive today for the trillions of people that will starseed the universe at some point in the future. I'm a presentist. I think if you're not doing it now in the moment, then that ends justifies the means thing is probably not going to happen. But I want to take a moment, though, to say the way this happens, though, was a kind of writing that is now going out of style as everyone runs to Substack and their independent whatevers. I wrote this piece for an editor at Medium, for a guy named Aaron Gell. And I wrote it where it was a piece about this kind of tech billionaire mindset. And at the very end of the piece, I mentioned, and, you know, by the way, you know, I even went to talk to these guys, these billionaire dudes, and all they cared about was their apocalypse bunkers, like an aside. And Eder, he calls me up on the phone and he goes, Doug, that's not, don't throw that away. That's your lead. I go, what do you mean it's my lead? It says, these are crazy guys. These are nothing. They're laughable. He goes, that's the lead. So I put it up at the front, and then the piece goes wild. And I realized, you know, we need other people. You got to work with other people. When we all think we know best, but boy, it really, having a great editor, and if you don't have an editor, having real friends look at it, if it takes an extra day or 2 days to post it, it's really right. Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to co-sign plus 100 on having somebody else read, because it helps, you know. It's writing 101, but, you know, I know we're all super individual right now, you know, get your own get yourself out there, branding. But it's also nice to share, to work with people. How about that? So I wanted to ask a question that was submitted by one of our Medium members. Okay, so this question is from Tessa Schlesinger. Okay, so she says, how do the super rich see the apocalypse that is coming? And that today's, I'm summarizing this. She's assuming that today's conditions could easily lead to another French Revolution. So she wants to know, what do they think is happening? Is it an apocalypse of a religious nature? Or is it more of like an extinction level event brought about, you know, by humans?
Well, in some ways, it's all of the above. You know, they're, as I see it, they're addicted to a narrative, you know, the sort of Aristotelian narrative, beginning, middle, end, you know, and any Marvel blockbuster, where's it going to go? It needs an end game, right? These guys have started businesses that are never about what the businesses do. These are businesses that are all about what? Their exit strategy. So if we are living in a world, right, that's dominated by businesses, and you're living on a landscape of businesses dedicated to exit strategies, where are you going to go with that? You're going to then need a meta exit strategy for the whole thing. You know, and the real thing that these guys are more scared of, even more scared of than they are of us, is AI. You know, I was at one of these retreats of, you know, the good tech bros, you know, the ones who come back from Burning Man and care about the world and all that. You know, the ones who saw the error of their ways and now want to lead humanity.
Right. Shout out Burning Man. I'm sure they're still driving home, but shout out.
Exactly. Figure out how they could turn their social media company into something good that still, you know, gets 100x return. But this guy was saying to me, says, God, you know, I've been looking at your tweets and Medium pieces, and you're saying a lot of really negative stuff about AI. Are you really comfortable with that? And I'm like, comfortable? What do you mean? He goes, well, when the AIs take over, they're going to see what you posted. He goes, I don't post anything about AI because I don't want them to know how I feel. And I'm like, yeah, but don't you think if AIs are smart enough, they could look at your posting pattern and the things that you're not saying and be able to infer using machine learning how you actually feel? And he looked at me, his jaw dropped like he was going to throw up or something. And so these kids, and they are kids, these tech bro children are plucked from college in the freshman year because they had a good idea before they took history, economics, philosophy, before the myelin sheaths have grown around the frontal lobes in their brains. They're young and they transfer parental authority onto a deal or a VC, and this is where they end up, like smarter than us, but like children, like teenagers.
Yeah, and it's interesting that all this coincides with the very change of structure of some public education systems and some private ones, you know. So this is a super heavy topic, but at the same time, it's also kind of light because some of it is pretty incredible, I have to be honest with you. But so is the flooding in Pakistan. So there are some very real things happening that we definitely, you know, need to deal with. So I think that, you know, we've asked a couple of questions from our members. Thank you so much for joining us. the next step. We're going to end on this final question. How can we be responsible tech users and responsible tech makers? What's best practice here?
I mean, it's almost the same thing. You know, a lot of it's what I wrote about way back in 2011 in a book called Programmer Be Programmed. Mm-hmm. You know, you've really got to look and ask yourself a few questions. Am I using this technology or is the technology using me? I mean, I remember in the late 80s when we hacked into a shopping mall, the hacker kid called it that he found an exploit. That's what we used to call it. We found an exploit in that machine so that we could get in there. And now when I talk to tech developers, they talk about finding exploits in humans, right? That we're going to create an algorithm that finds an exploit that basically uses one behavioral economics phenomenon or another against people. So I would say most simply, make technologies for people to use rather than technologies that use people. If you're in a meeting in your company and the language sounds like, how do we get people to do this? How do we get people to do that? Then you're using tech on the people, you know, rather than how do we allow people to do this? How do we empower people to do that if they want to? Is a very, very different approach. And I think you have to look at that when you're dealing with the technology. Is the technology connecting me to other people or alienating me from other people? Is the technology taking time and energy from me? Or is it actually giving me something that I want, you know, that I want to do? And it's basically that. And then finally, put the borders of the technology all the way back and all the way forward. Where did it come from? What children were sent into mines to get the rare earth metals to make these things? Where's the labor? Where are the externalities? Because our Macs, our iPhones are really good with their little Bauhaus elegance and making themselves look like closed systems, but they're not. They come from somewhere and they go somewhere. They impact people other than the ones you see. So think about that before you click on something.
Well, as they say, that is definitely a word. That is a word. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and insights with us. It's always a pleasure talking with you because I learn so much and I get to laugh.
Thank you for doing this. And honestly, there are, this was such an opportunity. I mean, I wrote a piece, work with somebody. I got a book and a movie. What you say they're going to make? I mean, we'll see. I get to do things like this. It's like, it can happen for you. But what I mean is we do. There are truly great things about the internet. I am not anti-tech. I hope no one thinks I sound anti-tech. I am pro-tech. This stuff is remarkable. It's just the people making and profiting off it, you know, are doing so at the expense of people and places. And we can do this way, way better.
Right. It sounds like the through line here is a little bit of, you know, to borrow a term, you know, collective work and responsibility.
There you go.
Might work out. Thank you for speaking with us, Douglas Rushkoff, editor, writer of Survival of the Richest, Escape Fantasies of the Tech Billionaires, and a writer on Medium. Thank you so much. Yeah. And I will see you on the social.
Well, that was a lot to pack into half an hour. I hope you liked it. It was the kind of online book party that Medium threw for Survival of the Richest, which you can get or read or steal or borrow. And I'll see you in a couple of days on the next regular Team Human episode. Take care.
With no fees or minimums on checking accounts, it's no wonder the Capital One Bank guy is so passionate about banking with Capital One. If he were here, he wouldn't just tell you about no fees or minimums. He'd also talk about how most Capital One cafes are open 7 days a week to assist with your banking needs. Yep, even on weekends, it's pretty much all he talks about. In a good way. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com/bank. Capital One N.A. member FDIC.